Today is Thursday, June 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up, we get the latest on Iran's shootdown of a U.S. military surveillance drone.
Aid agencies in Cameroon introduced the cash-based transfer program in 2016 to increase the efficiency of refugee support.
And today marks World Refugee Day. We hear how aid agencies are using new technology to help refugees. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, our top story today, Iran shot down a U.S. military surveillance drone last night, saying it was over Iranian territory. U.S. officials say the aircraft was flying in international territory. The incident is the latest in a series of events that are heightening tensions between Iran and the U.S. President Donald Trump. Last year, pulled the U.S. out of a multilateral treaty to curtail Iran's nuclear weapons program, saying it was inadequate. Since then, the U.S. has reinstated economic sanctions on Iran. The U.S. also blames Iran for several attacks on tanker ships in the strategically important Gulf of Oman. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is online with me to talk about the events of this past 24 hours. Hello, Carla.
Hi, Kim.
Carla, thanks for joining me. Now, can you just walk us through what's known about the drone shootdown so far?
That this was a drone, an unmanned drone. It was a Navy drone flying over the Gulf of Oman and the Strait of Hormuz. It was actually near the most recent attack on those two tankers. And they said that a surface-to-air missile was fired in the vicinity of Goruk, Iran, and hit their drone. And the top commander there says that this was an unprovoked attack on a U.S. surveillance asset that had not violated any Iranian airspace at the time during its mission. Iran counters that and says that it was in Iranian territory. We're just hearing now, just moments ago, the Pentagon released some footage of the downing of this drone, which could help to make their case that they were indeed in international waters. But this has definitely ratcheted up the tensions, and it's very difficult for President Trump. You hear him saying different things at different times. He said this morning that Iran has made a big mistake, and then we just heard moments ago he said that Iran might have mistakenly shot down the drone, but it was someone who was, quote, loose and stupid.
What has been some other reaction here in Washington, for instance, in Congress?
Well, Congress is slowly coming out with more and more details. We haven't heard any reaction at this point. I know that Congress has been calling for meetings on Iran because they want to steady the hand of what they see as a White House that is ready to go to war. We've heard from Pompeo pretty much on a daily basis, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, but today he's been silent on Iran. He's been focused on other things in the region. So I think that everybody in Washington is trying to regroup with this latest information and find out how to respond.
Now, of course, you talked about how tensions are increasing. So what is being done to try to ease these tensions?
Well, the United States just recently announced that they weren't easing tensions in any way, that they were actually going to be adding more troops for reconnaissance, intelligence, and surveillance gathering. As I was telling you, the officials here at the Pentagon believe that by watching Iran more, that will deter them from carrying out attacks. And they focus on the fact that this was an unmanned drone. Nobody has been hurt at this time. But this is a lot of money for the United States, and this is something that Iran should not have done if it is indeed over international waters, and probably shouldn't have done one way or the other. There should have been some sort of warning. So it will be interesting to see not only how the Congress is reacting and how the Secretary of State is reacting, but how the international community will be reacting over the next couple of days.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Carla, for keeping us up to date on these latest developments. That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Well, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un welcomed Chinese President Xi Jinping to Pyongyang today. Some have called it a historic visit to burnish any uneasy alliance. Xi's visit to Pyongyang comes after Kim has made four trips to Beijing and just ahead of the Group of 20 meeting to be held in Japan. For insight and analysis, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke with Jenny Town, a fellow at the Stimson Center, a policy research group here in Washington, and the managing editor of Stimson's 38 North, a website devoted to providing policy and technical analysis on North Korea.
Kim and Xi have met several times before, but this is Xi's first trip to Pyongyang and the first for a Chinese president in some 14 years. Why is Xi Jinping making the trip now?
It is a good question. Certainly, there was expectation that Xi would go to Pyongyang last year, and there was at least one planned visit that was postponed. So I don't think it's surprising that he's popped up in Pyongyang and is willing to go. The timing, you know, does align with an important China-North Korea holiday, celebrating their or commemorating their the long-standing bilateral relationship. I think the acceptance to go, knowing that it's a week before the G20 summit as well, probably is a secondary factor in this, and sort of an added bonus for Xi to be able to carry messages to President Trump as well, if there's something to be said to help get the process moving, the USCPRK negotiation process back on track.
You mentioned the stalled talks between Washington and Pyongyang, but also Beijing and Washington are in the middle of trade disputes with tariffs going back and forth between the two governments. Now, since Xi and Kim said they were going to discuss important regional issues during their two-day summit, what realistically can either really achieve to move their respective agendas forward in such a short meeting?
Well, I don't expect too much. Certainly, they will talk about the negotiation process. I think the Chinese really want to make sure that the North Koreans stay engaged. And, you know, but are still sympathetic to the concept that any kind of denuclearization process has to be phased and has to deal also with North Korea's strategic interests and their security concerns. I think similar to, you know, the Putin-Kim summit, that there, you know, that North Korea is, you know, leaning on its relatively sympathetic voices, although both China and Russia are, you know, also want North Korea to go down that denuclearization road. I think there might also be some level of competition going on, you know, between China and Russia to maintain some competition for influence in the region and trying to ensure that, you know, China's influence still is higher than that of Russia. I do think, too, there's also a bit of a message to President Moon here as well, again, sort of underscoring how much the credibility of Moon has really eroded in North Korea for Kim Jong-un as well, with Moon being unable to move forward with the inter-Korean agenda because he's not getting cooperation from the United States.
Is there anything else you think we should be watching out for as day two of the Kim-Xi summit gets underway on Friday?
I think it'd be really interesting to see how the media covers it. It was, of course, very unusual for them to talk about the visit before it happened, especially unusual for them to actually publish, you know, an editorial by Xi Jinping in advance of the conference as well. It's not unusual for Xi Jinping to do such an editorial before making a state visit. But it's a new response from North Korea to actually promote it in such a way, and I think it's very similar to when Kim Jong-un allowed Moon Jae-in to address the Supreme People's Assembly as well, that, you know, he's willing to do things a little bit different if it helps support and help build support domestically for the agenda that he wants to pursue.
A Among the top stories in the world, U.S. and Canadian leaders discuss trade a day after Mexico became the first to ratify a new three-nation trade deal. An Organization of American States delegation is in Haiti to discuss the country's political crisis, and environmentalists urge Southeast Asia nations to ban imports of plastic waste. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Today is World Refugee Day, and the UN Refugee Agency reports nearly 71 million people around the world and now are displaced by war, persecution, and conflict. This is the highest level since the UNHCR was established nearly 70 years ago. The refugee agency also calls that figure conservative because the Venezuelan crisis is not factored in. About 4 million Venezuelans have fled their country, but very few have formally applied for asylum, so they are not counted in the refugee statistics. UN officials say most refugees would like to go home, but usually are unable to do so because of prolonged crises in their home countries. The UNHCR reports that last year, slightly less than 600,000 refugees were able to return home, while only 92,400 were resettled in third countries. Well, as the world struggles to aid the millions of displaced people around the globe, aid agencies are adopting new technology. In refugee camps in Cameroon, food aid has been replaced by mobile money payments. The system allows refugees to choose what food they buy and allows women to rely less on their husbands in the mostly polygamous society. Moki Edwin Kinzika has this report by Anne Marielle Inkazao in Gado, Cameroon.
Jenaba Abdoulaye, a Central African Republic refugee in eastern Cameroon, no longer has to ask her husband for rations of food aid. Instead, she does her weekly shopping with aid money for refugees that was transferred directly to her mobile phone. Jenaba says the program helped her a lot by giving her a lot of capabilities. As she is in a polygamous home of three women, her husband used to take food for all of the family and shared it among the three wives. Now, she says, each wife has her phone, benefits from the assistance for her children and herself, and uses it as she wants. Aid agencies in Cameroon introduced the cash-based transfer program in 2016 to increase the efficiency of refugee support. Before the transfer program, only the head of a refugee household, usually the husband, received the monthly rations of oil, salt, sugar, beans, and cassava flour. The mobile payment system is not unique to Cameroon. But for the mostly polygamous CAR refugees, it has been empowering because every wife is treated as head of a household and receives a monthly allowance. Nana Amao is head of the local World Food Program office.
The WFP is currently assisting 48,000, just about 48,000 refugees via cash-based transfer. And one of the main reasons why cash is becoming more and more important in the humanitarian context is for WFP, it gives the beneficiaries the choice of food to select in the food basket that's available.
The WFP provides refugees with a mobile phone and SIM card that access an electronic portfolio to receive the monthly allowances. The electronic transfer of aid has also helped male refugees, like local shopkeeper Mama Lamin. He says the program allowed him to take care of himself and to solve the problems of his family. Now, he no longer depends on food assistance, says Lamin, and can take care of his children's school fees and equip his house. While limited by telecommunications, the use of mobile cash transfers is expected to grow and give more refugees choices about what they do with the aid they receive. For Anne Zwanke in Gado, Cameroon, Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News.
Well, today a Hungarian court extended the prison sentences of four human traffickers. The men were convicted last year for their roles in the 2015 deaths of 71 migrants who suffocated in the back of a truck in Austria. The victims from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan were among hundreds of thousands of people who fled to Europe that year, escaping war and poverty in their home countries. The Hungarian appeals court today sentenced three men, an Afghan man and two Bulgarian accomplices, to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Another Bulgarian man must spend at least 30 years in prison. Last year, all four were sentenced to 25 years in prison for belonging to a criminal organization and crimes that include human smuggling and manslaughter. Prosecutors challenged that sentence, saying it was too light. A British court ruled today that the UK government broke the law by selling weapons to Saudi Arabia that were used in the Yemen war. The Court of Appeal ruled in favor of anti-weapons activists who argued the sales should not have been allowed because there was a clear risk the weapons could be used in violation of international humanitarian law. The Associated Press's Charles de Ledesma has more.
The British Court of Appeal has agreed with anti-weapons campaigners that the sales should not have been allowed because there was a risk that the weapons might be used in violation of humanitarian law. The group, Campaign Against Arms Trade, says British bombs and fighter jets are fueling violence in Yemen, where a Saudi-led war against Iran-backed rebels has raged since 2015. In the ruling, three judges said the British government had made no attempt to find out whether the Saudi-led coalition had breached international rules. The court's ruling, though, does not mean arms sales licenses must be suspended, only that the government must reconsider the sales. Charles de Ledesma, London.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
In Britain, two Conservative Party cabinet ministers are now fighting it out to join Boris Johnson in the runoff vote to become the next prime minister. Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt and Environment Secretary Michael Gove both hope to take on Johnson, considered the frontrunner. By the end of the day, the Conservatives are expected to settle on the final two candidates. The ruling party's members will vote next month on their choice to replace Prime Minister Theresa May. May is resigning after failing repeatedly to get an agreement on the British exit from the EU through Parliament. The three candidates have not ruled out leaving the bloc without a deal on future relations with Brussels. The Bank of England, business organizations, and many economists warn a disorderly breakup could create significant economic disruption. Well, the U.S. Census Bureau says Americans are getting older. New figures released today show the median age in the U.S. increased by a year to 38.2 years from 2010 to 2018. A major reason? The baby boomers, many of the Americans born between the end of World War II and 1964, have been hitting the retirement mark in the past 8 years. Ben Thomas with the Associated Press has more.
From 2010 to 2018, the median age of Americans increased by 1 year to 38.2. In Puerto Rico, the median age jumped nearly 6 years to 42.8, largely the result of younger people moving to the U.S. mainland after Hurricane Maria hit in 2017. Among states, Maine had the greatest increase. The median age there rose 2.2 years to 44.9. And the only state with a decrease was North Dakota. It's seen a population boom driven by growth in the energy sector, and that's helped pull down the median age to 35.2. I'm Ben Thomas.
This is Science in a Minute.
A study led by the University of Buffalo, New York, has confirmed the identity of fossilized hyena teeth that were discovered in the North American Arctic in the 1970s. The fossils were found to be of an extinct species called the running hyena. According to the study, the fossils discovered in Canada's Yukon Territory date between 1.4 million and 850 million years ago during the last ice age. Although scientists had earlier identified the hyena fossils, this new study not only confirms their identity, but also provides detailed information on the discovery. Fossils of this animal species had been previously found in Africa, Europe, Asia, and the southern United States. The study authors theorize that the ancient hyenas made their way from Asia to North America via the Bering Land Bridge that once connected the two continents. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
U.S. aircraft maker Boeing is working to overcome the legacy of two deadly air crashes involving its 737 MAX 8 aircraft. Last November in Indonesia and earlier this year in Ethiopia, 737 MAX jets crashed, killing all on board after sensors gave pilots incorrect data. At the Paris Air Show this week, Boeing has issued apologies and has pledged to do better. It also has fixed software on the planes and promised to work with airlines on training pilots. Rita Foley with the Associated Press reports that might be paying off.
Boeing VP Ihssane Mounir says several companies around the world are considering new 737 MAX orders. He was at the Paris Air Show.
We've been devastated by the two accidents, the loss of life. Our teams have been reflecting on this daily since it happened. And to come to this show and receive such a strong expression of support from our customers, from many industry partners, it's been very, very touching and it's been very humbling.
IAG, owner of British Airways and several other carriers, signed a letter of intent for 200 MAX aircraft worth $24 billion. I'm Rita Foley.
Scientists today said they have found the earliest signs of Parkinson's disease in the brain years before patients show any symptoms. Parkinson's, a neurodegenerative disorder that causes movement and cognitive problems, is estimated to affect up to 10 million people worldwide. The cause is not clear, but it is diagnosed by a buildup in the brain of protein. Some people are born with a genetic mutation that makes it highly likely they will develop the disease. Scientists at London's King's College studied patients with the genetic mutation as well as others without it. They found that changes in the serotonin system in the brains of Parkinson's sufferers started to malfunction well before other symptoms occurred. The discovery makes it easier to find people at risk of developing the disease and monitor their symptoms. The researchers say it could help find new treatments. Well, you've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Jackson Mbunganyi, and our engineer, Aiden Utko. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, how long can a head of state maintain effective leadership? Some African leaders are forced out of office, while others respect the political process. The politics of transition on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcast. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA News Feeds.